We're now going to be drilling into risk appetite in a little more detail and start exploring some of the challenges in a little more detail. We'll be starting with Mark Lawrence. Mark is the Managing Director of the Mark Lawrence Group, a global risk consultancy that was established in 2008. He's an internationally recognised speaker and is currently co-chair of the Risk Management Working Group at the Washington-based Institute of International Finance. So it certainly comes with a lot of accolades. He's benefited from 13 years' experience in senior risk management roles, largely in New York, and prior to that was a principal at McKinsey. He's also spent 5 years as chief risk officer at the ANZ Bank. Mark will be followed by Damien Green. Damien is the CAO of AIA, a role he took up in 2009. He joined AIA in 2006, initially as head of group insurance, and prior to that was general manager of business development at Australian Super. He's played a leading role within Australia at consolidating industry funds. Mark will be talking about the need to establish risk appetite frameworks and some of the failings that occurred during the financial crisis. And Damien will talk about some of the practical and cultural issues associated with embedding an ERM capability. So please join me in welcoming Mark and Damien to the stage.
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to begin by thanking the Institute for the invitation to speak to you this morning on risk appetite, a subject that has risen to prominence almost seemingly from nowhere as a result of the global financial crisis, and a topic that I've spent probably 80% of my last 12 months working on. So it's a great honour, and I hope that I can share with you a couple of things that might be interesting and helpful for you. So I guess the first question is, why is it that if you attended any risk conference in 2007, the topic risk appetite didn't appear on the agenda? And yet here we are, it's somehow central to what we're doing today here in this seminar and also in many risk conferences around the world. Well, the answer is that risk appetite emerged as one of the key failures that contributed to and drove the global financial crisis. So to do this fairly quickly, I want to draw your attention to a rather important, very fundamental report on the risk management and governance failures in the largest financial firms that was issued by something called the Senior Supervisors Group last year, about 3 weeks after the first ERM seminar here in Sydney a year ago. The Senior Supervisors Group is a bunch of North Atlantic regulators, principally bank regulators, who essentially got together and compared notes about what worked and what didn't in the financial crisis in risk management. They issued two reports which had a big impact on the trajectory of the industry and the industry work since the onset of the crisis. The first one was a very short report in March of 2008. The second one was a much more thorough and detailed analysis of the critical failings that occurred in the biggest firms in particular on either side of the North Atlantic in the crisis. And I just want to draw your attention or highlight some of the key conclusions from that report last October. So it's a 40-something page report, very small font, a lot of very detailed information in there about what went wrong and what didn't work, and it's very, very scathing about the progress made in the industry even as of last October. Much work to do. But in particular, it focuses in its executive summary on the governance failures that occurred in the largest institutions. And I want to just highlight a couple of these things. So in the executive summary, overarching observations, weaknesses in governance, incentives, and infrastructure undermined the effectiveness of risk controls and contributed to last year, 2008, systemic vulnerability. The point that I want to highlight for you is the unwillingness or inability of boards of directors and senior managers to articulate, measure, and then adhere to a level of risk that was acceptable to the firm. Now, that's astonishing. We're not talking about one institution here. We're talking about a systemic observation, applying very specifically in this case to the 20 largest financial institutions on either side of the North Atlantic in the relevant countries. Again, the unwillingness or inability of boards of directors and senior managers to articulate, measure, and then adhere to a level of risk acceptable to the firm. Continuing. The senior supervisors group saw a disparity between the risks that their firms took and those that their boards of directors perceived the firms to be taking. If you will, a cognitive failure in the boardroom. The boards did not understand the risks that were being taken by the management. They saw, across this group of large institutions, insufficient evidence of active board involvement in setting the risk appetite for firms in a way that recognises the implications of that risk-taking. In other words, effective boundaries for risk-taking were not set in advance. Boards failed to contain the management's risk-taking. Now, this is very concerning. This is a very deep and fundamental governance failure. We heard Craig talk about the role of the board. Fundamentally, it is the accountability of the board to define that risk appetite, to set the boundary of acceptable risk, and then ensure that the management is acting within that boundary. What this senior supervisors group report is saying is that systemically, that didn't happen. So what should we do about it? In that same report from October last year, 18 months on from the onset, or 2 years on from the onset of the financial crisis in sort of mid to late 2007, as of October last year, the senior supervisors group identified no fewer than 10 critical areas where improvement is still needed, and they're listed on this slide. And the second one on the slide, by the way, these are, the last two slides in this one are actually slides from a presentation, taken from a presentation by the head of the senior supervisors group. I've literally just cut and pasted his slides into this presentation. The second one here is articulating risk appetite, and this has been a principal area of focus for the senior supervisors group and all of those relevant national supervisors over the past 12 months, and a topic of active dialogue between the industry and supervisors. So this is one of the driving forces behind why risk appetite, as we call it now, has sort of rocketed up the charts, if you will, to be one of the really hot topics. And as Craig indicated, it's actually very, very difficult and challenging to do this well. And boards around the world are grappling with this topic right now and trying to strengthen their institution's risk appetite capabilities. So I'm going to put a slide up that I actually did present a year ago. with a slightly different colour scheme, and sort of a little bit of history on this risk appetite topic. So we say here that clarifying and precisely defining your risk appetite and then embedding it down into the business so that the business can understand and see clearly those boundaries is an important CEO and board responsibility, but it's evolved considerably as a result of the lessons learned from the crisis. And I really liked when Craig talked about the importance of making it simple for the business to understand. If the business doesn't understand the boundaries, then it's very, very difficult for them to, A, stay within the boundaries, and B, optimize their allocation of resources within those boundaries. So prior to the financial crisis, risk appetite was typically a pretty vague notion, and it was all handled pretty informally. I used to be the chief risk officer at ANZ last century. And the CEO would just talk very generally about being low risk. Sounds good. Except that when you looked in detail at the growth targets and the operating plans year on year, the growth ambition was actually pretty aggressive. And it was never really clear if the growth ambition was really consistent with this notion of low risk. It's a little bit like beauty. It was in the eye of the beholder. And certainly for some of the business people who were tasked with meeting those performance objectives, those two were clearly in conflict. So this is a little bit the problem. We need to be more specific than merely a target credit rating or a target for earnings volatility. Back then, prior to the crisis, it was implicitly expected and understood in many institutions that individual business units would selectively dial up their actual risk-taking within individual performance or reporting periods if they needed to in order to meet their targets. And that presumably usually happened within certain unspoken or implicit boundaries, hopefully. But that was the hallmark of a good manager. I won't name names, but there are some who are quite famous for being able to do that and who did it well year after year after year, for more than a decade in some cases. And the CEO would just rely on the head of the business to exercise that appropriate balance, that judgment, that discretion between risk-taking and return, but count on the individual business managers to meet their targets. However, during the bubble which preceded the crisis, in pursuit of incremental revenue, individual businesses within many firms, especially on either side of the North Atlantic, took substantial risks that they didn't understand and that they were not explicitly authorized to take. For example, if anybody at UBS had taken a paper to the board and said, "I think we should buy $60 billion worth of super senior tranches of CDOs of US subprime mortgage-backed securities," it's entirely possible that the board would have taken 15 minutes, thought about it, and said, maybe that's not a good idea. In fact, there wasn't such a paper to the board. It was just AAA is AAA, and away we go. So the resulting catastrophic losses underscored that the aggregate integrated risk profile is really opaque. Very, very hard to understand, especially when it's changing rapidly, to insiders as well as outsiders. And so post-crisis, it's now become essential to clarify in advance exactly which risks are acceptable and how much of each can be taken, both in each business individually and in aggregate. And to do that with rigor and precision is really difficult. And one of the things I want to highlight in the next few minutes is some of the challenges that you typically encounter, that firms have encountered and are encountering in trying to do that. So at this moment, I just want to mention to you some of the work of this Global Risk Management Working Group at the Institute of International Finance. What is the Institute of International Finance? Some of you will have heard of it. You can think of it a little bit like the global version of the ABA. So it's principally banks, but many or most of the really big global insurers are members as well. Rating agencies are members. A lot of the big investors are members as well. And it has a risk management working group that published some guidance for the industry on four very specific topics in December last year. One was risk culture. What is it? Gave a definition of risk culture, highlighted the characteristics of a robust and strong risk culture. The second was risk appetite. An initial discussion paper, 20 pages, on risk appetite. Why it's important, how to think about it, the key elements of risk appetite, and some of the challenges associated with that. A third paper was on the limitations of risk models, and a fourth one was on the challenges of internally managing pro-cyclicality. So this paper on risk appetite in December last year, the reference is in the appendix to these slides if you're interested, made some initial recommendations about how firms should tackle risk appetite, the risk appetite challenge. However, the dialogue this year between the industry through the IIF and the senior supervisors group and individual national supervisors in the Northern Hemisphere has highlighted that everybody on both the supervisory side and the industry side feels that progress in this area has been inadequate. As a consequence of this, a month or two ago, the IIF decided to do a deeper piece of work on risk appetite. And in particular, to do a deep analysis of the impediments that have emerged over the last 12 or 18 months from in firms that have tried to take this risk appetite process on. So I want to just quickly mention some of these illustrative impediments for you. And what the IAF is doing now is sending out in the next month a survey to all member firms, both to the senior management and to directors, and saying, okay, in your institution, if you've tried to do risk appetite, what are the key impediments that have emerged for you, and what's worked for you in trying to grapple with these impediments? And there will also be a phase of deep structured interviews, both with CEOs, chief risk officers, and with directors as well, with the intention of publishing a deeper analysis and making some additional recommendations for tackling those impediments next year. So what kind of impediments are we talking about? Well, they can broadly be put into no fewer than 8 categories, believe it or not. So the first one is buy-in to the concept. Board and senior management buy into the whole idea of risk appetite. After all, we didn't used to do this, did we? We had limits. What more do we need? So what are the impediments? Well, first of all, a lot of folks don't understand it. This is what's been coming out over the last 12 months or so. Don't see the point. Don't see the value. Hey, we've done okay as we are. We didn't have a problem. Hey, especially here in Australia, right? We're excellent. We don't need to do this. So, okay, we've got to do this really because the supervisors wanted us to do it. Okay, better tick a few boxes and go through. In some instances, the board absolutely gets it in the post-crisis environment, but there's a deep concern about the sustainability of the focus and the priority on this once things settle down. Then, of course, as mentioned already, it's a pretty technical area. So you have to come to grips with the technicalities. So, great idea in some institutions, but the board doesn't really understand risk. Either some of the risk types deeply enough to have this discussion in a robust way, or for that matter, how they interact, because this is really about the interaction and the aggregation of risk. The board needs training, needs really some education, and that takes time. So we can't really do this yet, or can't do it meaningfully. Sometimes there are relationship managers, sometimes we just, relationship issues, sometimes there just isn't enough expertise in the board. In institutions that are doing it, how do you make it meaningful? In some instances, the management does the numbers and the numbers look pretty horrible. And sometimes there's a reluctance to present those ugly numbers up in the boardroom. Sometimes stress test results, which are big, get discounted. Sometimes we get stuck on bland value statements. I know of one top 20 global financial institution that spent 8 months doing risk appetite and came out with 3 paragraphs at the end result of that process in December last year. And fundamentally, it's very difficult to translate board preferences down into operational guidelines. The measurement of risk is challenging. So, risk IT in many institutions just doesn't work well enough. There's in some institutions, there's a legacy sort of spaghetti of IT systems that haven't been integrated. And it's impossible, really, or very difficult to pull together aggregate risk information, even by risk type and even for individual business lines across the institution. Sometimes the key risk measures are not robust or credible. People don't believe them. They just don't feel these numbers are robust enough for us to make these kinds of decisions based on these. I guess the critical part is taking action and making a difference. What's the point of going through a process in the boardroom if nothing changes? If it has no impact? What are some of the issues that come up here? Many. The first one is that, which I've seen in several big institutions in the last 6 months, is that it becomes too difficult for the board to make a trade-off and the leadership, the senior executive, to make the trade-off between, unacceptable outcomes that occur with an extremely low probability, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 3,000, right, which effectively wipe out your capital, right? On the one hand, it might lead you to want to cut risk across the board, but then that damages your ongoing business in the sort of business as usual environment, which is sort of the environment, you know, in which all of our plans are made. You know, we are here to provide, you know, services to our customers and to the community. And we can scale everything back. If we're a bank, we can scale back the provision of credit. You know, if we're insurers, we can scale back the provision of those services on the basis of wanting to protect ourselves against a 1 in 1,000 event. But how do we make that trade-off? Because most likely scaling back is going to have an impact on our customers, our shareholders, and the community. And that trade-off is extremely difficult to make. Supervisors in some institutions seem to want institutions to cut, always, because the extreme stress loss, as calculated in this process, is too great. But institutions sometimes, you know, find that very difficult to do. How do you make that trade-off? That's very hard. I'll speed up a little bit here. Is it possible to define principles for making these responsible trade-offs at the group level in decision-making? It's very hard. What's historically happened is boards get comfortable with the activities of individual business units one at a time. And it's really the aggregation where things look unacceptable, or where boards can get worried about the aggregate level of risk. Well, then what do you do? What kind of principles can you use to tackle that? How do you respond to a rapidly changing risk environment, as we saw at the onset and the early stages of the crisis? One of the great problems in many institutions is that these higher-level risk appetite discussions don't really get translated in a meaningful way to the businesses and line managers. So, in practice, it's difficult to see, understand, and act. And we need to link these high-level discussions in the boardrooms with that, with those practical points. Okay, how do you stick with it? Let's say you get this up and you do it once, and everybody sort of learns a lot, thinks it's good, but is pretty exhausted at the end of the process. And frankly, there's an awful lot of other things on the board agenda, and sometimes there's a reluctance to do it again. Oh God, here we go. We really don't want to do this again yet. Let's defer, right? It's a cost-benefit thing. We did all this work, but where's the benefit really? It doesn't seem as if the reward for the effort is sort of commensurate. How do we sustain the interest post the crisis? We have to persuade our stakeholders, especially our supervisors, that we really mean it, right? How can we communicate that? How can we communicate to our employees and to all of our stakeholders the benefits of these, of this process, especially when a lot of what goes on is confidential? And finally, there's an awful lot of process challenges that institutions report. So this is just to give you a feel for the kinds of impediments that come up when you actually do this. If you really try to grasp the nettle of doing risk appetite, you run into some, or indeed many, of these impediments. So given all of this, what should we do? I think we're supposed to be giving you some tips. I think I've talked a little bit about the traps. So this is my last slide. So here are some tips, okay? The first thing to say is that all firms will do this differently. I think the single most important thing is whatever you're doing, it should work for you. And you should really own it. Don't follow somebody else's list. Don't try to do it the way anybody else does it. Really do it, really invent it, create it, develop it, and own it yourselves in your institutions so that you can understand it and your businesses can understand it, as Craig said before. So here's a few tips that seem to work in some places. Start simple and take an iterative approach to defining your risk appetite more precisely. Craig talked about the approach at AMP being iterative and dynamic. I really like that. And they were using profit at risk as a key metric. Focus on the major risks first, because those are the ones that you really need to define the boundary most clearly. Use stress testing to understand the aggregation of risk. It's sometimes tempting to just add, you know, capital or whatever, but actually that's not that helpful. When this really matters is in the stress scenario or the extreme scenario. Use stress testing, invest in stress testing to do that. Continue to evolve and develop your analytics over time. Set clear goals for your minimum capital liquidity reserve positions that have to be preserved after sustaining the large losses under extreme scenarios. and taking into account your earnings capacity, which will probably be reduced in that scenario. Set those goals and communicate those and stick to them. Because those goals, we must retain X amount of capital or certain ratios, right, will drive the decision-making process at the core. Be honest about your strengths and weaknesses. What are your competitive advantages and your risk management capabilities, right? Remember who you are. I have a particular client that does a lot of capital markets trading in an emerging market. And I have to keep saying, you know what? That's great. That's good. But you're not Goldman Sachs, actually. We're our sponsor for this seminar. You know, remember who you are. Your capabilities are not their capabilities. And you've got to adjust your risk appetite accordingly. Focus on that trade-off, that difficult trade-off that I talked about, between the need to constrain risks in order to contain the impact of catastrophic losses under highly unlikely scenarios versus the impact of that risk reduction on your revenues under business-as-usual conditions. There's no single right way to make that trade-off. Different firms will make it differently, but make it consciously. Avoid blind reliance on your models. Understand your limitations and assumptions. And Craig talked about that earlier. But just make sure that that risk tolerance, that risk appetite is consistent with your performance objectives and your capital, funding, liquidity, and reserve positions. Ensure that the boundaries of acceptable risk-taking, whatever results from this process, are clear. That's the point. Employees and business unit leaders should understand the boundaries clearly. And then finally, closely monitor your evolving risk profile under changing conditions and respond quickly to cut those risks that you can control when needed. So, two things. The recommendations from the 2009 IIF report that I mentioned are in an appendix. For reasons of time, we don't have time to go into those now, but if you're interested, this paper will be on the website shortly. And secondly, there is this new IIF analysis going on from the Risk Management Working Group, which is going to be quite deep and detailed and investigate many of those impediments that I have briefly shown you here. And two things. First of all, I'd invite your participation in that process. If you would like to be involved, let me know. And secondly, there should be a paper with some additional discussion and recommendations about how to address those impediments, I would say by about March of April of next year. Thank you for your time.
Very good. Mark certainly painted a picture of some of the challenges ahead of us in terms of implementing risk appetite framework. So let's get more of a practical perspective and some thoughts on culture from Damien Green. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Good morning, and thank you to the Institute for the opportunity to be with you and to address you today and participate in this vital discussion. I would like to speak a little bit more about behaviour, people, culture. I think the objective of moving to genuine enterprise-wide risk management is something that is accepted, and I'll take that as given and granted has been something that this group embraces, as do I. But I'd like to talk about people and cultural responses, particularly to organisations that overstretch a little in terms of implementing ERM models of various kinds. I'd like to bring a more of a practical perspective, I guess, particularly from the perspective of an organisation like AIA Australia, which is intermediate on the maturity scale. And if you look at the matrix that the International Actuarial Association provides in its paper on its practice note on ERM, and you assess our business, that's exactly where we sit in terms of the maturity of our business, intermediate. Risk appetite statements are important, that is for sure, but there are other fundamentals to consider that will make or break the success of any ERM framework, particularly for less mature organisations. So in my view, there are four interlinked fundamental elements upon which a transition to enterprise-wide risk management is dependent. One, And first and foremost, we should ensure the enterprise risk management framework we are seeking to implement and our near-term objectives in this regard are proportionate to our own organisation's maturity and stage of development. This is my key point today, and I think it's critical. Two, we need to ensure the right... Obviously, we need to ensure the right organisational culture and behaviour, but I believe this is a foundation, and this cannot be driven and delivered by process. In fact, I think that's counterproductive. Three, we need to give permission for enterprise risk management to genuinely represent upside and downside risks. And we need to do that through actions rather than simple urging. And lastly, I think we need to link an ongoing consideration of emerging risks and even black swan events, albeit unlikely, with business strategy and planning. And I think that is the fourth fundamental element that needs to be laid down to see success in terms of implementation of genuine enterprise-wide risk management. I think the interplay between these elements is critical. And this is something that we've been working through at AIA Australia in light of our strong commitment to maturing our approach to ERM. Now, from my perspective, the major risk in this area is to implement an ERM model that is disproportionate to an organisation's stage of development and state of maturity. That is, it's too advanced and the organisation simply isn't ready for it. This means, and this is the behavioural piece, the behavioural response. This means the organisation will struggle to see its relevance, potentially leading to it becoming an imposed process that is perceived to be a compliance requirement. And I think we're all familiar with that. It's the elephant in the room. The result is that the upside risk takers in our business, those very important decision makers, will tend to be marginalised from this process, which then sees risk management perceived as being focused only on downside risks and therefore risk elimination, and then we start to defeat our purpose. This in turn perpetuates a more polarised culture between the business and risk and compliance, rather than a uniform risk consciousness running through an entire business. The siloed culture that results from this makes it permissible for the business's risk takers to work around rather than embrace risk management, which is dangerous and in turn promotes the wrong behaviours and culture. Of course, none of this is conducive to the emergence of genuine enterprise-wide risk management, which is what we're talking about today, within an organisation, as the objectives of moving to the right culture and behaviour and the inclusion of upside risk-taking are defeated. Now, in terms of risk appetite statement, for a less mature organisation in particular, I actually think it's the dialogue and the engagement around developing the risk appetite statement that counts. Again, the IAA states that the key to the implementation of an effective risk management framework, is buy-in and support from the board, and the previous speakers have referred to this a couple of times. To me, that means for an organisation to transition to an effective ERM culture, its board must concern itself with the risk of risk-adjusted decision-making, clearly. But to do this, it must, obviously articulate a risk appetite statement as a starting point. Now, in the context of this objective and the objective of the board to foster a risk management culture, as important as the risk appetite statement itself, and this is my contention for a developing organisation in terms of maturity, as important as the statement itself is the very engagement, the ongoing engagement that between management and the board in particular that leads to the establishment of the statement. Now, whilst I believe that risk appetite statements from the board is essential to a properly functioning framework for ERM, for a less mature organisation, I believe the process, as I've said, of agreeing the statement is actually is of much value as, for example, establishing a technical risk management objective flowing from the risk appetite statement, such as the setting of qualitative risk tolerances. So I think that the impact on culture and the development of a risk culture that trickles down from the board and the executive flowing on from the engagement that is required to set a risk appetite statement is equally important to a business as the statement itself. Now, as I've said, AIA Australia is classed as an intermediate organisation. The process that we used to articulate a risk appetite statement is both proportionate to our stage of maturity and, as discussed, designed in itself to promote a risk management culture from and within our board and executive team through a process of engagement. Now, as reflected in much of the literature on this subject, and undoubtedly in each of our own experiences, engagement is critical to achieving a change to any culture, and in this case, moving an organisation to a genuine risk management culture. This engagement must start between the board and the executive, but clearly the starting point is the board, which has to be prepared to establish a risk appetite statement in the context of the business that it's involved in to kick off this process. Now, from our perspective, the literature on risk appetite can be a little ambiguous, and trying to clearly differentiate between risk appetite and risk tolerance can consume a fair amount of time and effort. We resolved this in terms of engagement with our board on risk appetite statement by taking a simple view and clearly defining risk appetite as a qualitative view, or a statement, if you like, of risk principles, principle statements, which represent a broad statement of the board's attitude toward risk. Now, we defined risk tolerance then to be more quantitative in nature as a means, obviously, to provide more physical tolerances that set the physical outer markers for the board's risk appetite. Now, to facilitate the engagement between the board and our executive, we have been conducting intensive half-day sessions, which we call risk-a-thons, every six months or so, between the executive and the board. They're intensive sessions, as I've said. They're facilitated and focus on the widest possible discussion on organisational and environmental strategic risks. These sessions have been incredibly effective. They've stimulated risk management thinking amongst the board and the executive team, have worked to deepen engagement between the executive and the board around strategic risks. This has been effective in creating an environment within our business and a current of thought, more properly, that is conducive to taking the next step to clearly articulate a risk appetite statement. So we've been doing our risk-a-thon sessions in the lead-up to, if you like, in the 12 months before we established a risk appetite statement. Our risk-a-thon sessions have culminated, as I've said, in a couple of intensive sessions dedicated to actually articulating the board's risk appetite statement. Now, obviously, and perhaps to state the obvious, risk appetite discussions revolve around the different types of risks to the business. So our board has considered market, credit, liquidity, insurance, catastrophe, strategic and operational risk, as well as potential black swan events. And inevitably, and this makes our Chief Actuary, Tim Chambers, very, very happy, this leads to a level of risk assessment involving a consideration of tail risk and extreme events. But we try not to spend too much time on that. Once the board sets its risk appetite, which is a broad qualitative statement, as I've said, this then leads to the development of the more quantitative risk tolerances, which in our case go around capital protection, profit volatility, financial strength ratings, return on equity and operational risk. Now, clearly, AMP, for an insurer looking to protect its ability to make good on our commitments to our policyholders and our shareholders, capital risk protection is the focus and the priority in terms of the board's risk appetite statement. Now, following this, we intend to establish, flowing on from the quantitative risk tolerances, more granular risk limits or operational criteria and day-to-day controls that are designed to set quantitative limits that are consistent both with the risk tolerances and then more broadly with the board's statement of risk principles in its risk appetite statement. Now, I believe culture and behaviour is as critical to a developing business as the risk appetite statement, as it may well be to any business. In reference to the effectiveness of the formal governance structures, the IAA states that enterprise risk management doesn't just concern itself with process around risk controls, but also with behaviours, which it defines as risk management culture. Now, I firmly believe this is right, and I believe that behaviour and culture should be placed at the front line of our approach to risk management. In many ways, capital should be seen as the last line of defence, and I'm confident that at least our shareholders see the former as being far more palatable. It follows that if we genuinely believe that enterprise-wide risk management that is embedded into culture is what will define a successful modern insurance business, and I believe that, then we had better embrace a new kind of enterprise-wide culture and a set of behaviours within our organisations. And my contention is that, in life insurance at least, we do have some way to go in Australia. Now, by embracing this reality and making the appropriate changes to our behaviours through employee management practices, we will take the first legitimate step towards risk management being genuinely embedded into the cultures of our respective enterprises. As a constructive exercise, and perhaps to engender some debate, we should form a view in our minds of the personality of the type of ideal risk-competent individual we would recruit, promote, foster within any part of our respective organisations, but particularly as decision makers at all levels, from sales managers to CEOs, let's say. Now, I believe the most critical individual behavioural attributes that are conducive to an effective risk management culture are as follows. A concern with the business achieving its objectives, obviously. Importantly, a pursuit of career satisfaction through attainment of some level of leadership, which necessarily means a medium to long-term focus from the individual. A lower priority on short-term personal objectives such as pure financial motivations. Indeed, we'd be looking for people who have less fear of not achieving their short-term objectives, I should say. An enterprise-wide view or interest, a thoughtful or intellectual disposition, clearly not lacking in this room, and proactivity, forthrightness, and finally, an innate sense of ethics and morality. Now, you might think these things are no-brainers, but how many organisations sit down and carefully design and plan their recruitment, promotion and employee development practices around these specific attributes? And if we did that more broadly and in more of an applied and deliberate fashion, I would put it to you that it will have a significant impact on the risk management cultures within our businesses. And we've been having a go at this at AIA, Australia. We employ around 400 people, and it is easier for us to do, but we're starting to see the benefits. You know, in summary, our respective organisations need to deliberately recruit, promote and foster individuals who will naturally do the right thing every time. I certainly believe the days of cowboy behaviour within life insurance, otherwise defined as cynical, self-serving and opaque behaviour, ought to be over, but it isn't. And this is something we strongly believe in at AIA Australia and as a building block for a more contemporary corporate culture. The journey for us has not always been easy in this regard, as some people inevitably exit the organisation and others find themselves no longer valued. However, we've been applying ourselves to this for the past 18 months, and we're certainly starting to notice the benefits in terms of culture within our organisation. And our business results reflect that positive move, which is excellent, and a validation. Now, this deliberate talent management strategy is being carried out in the broader context of fostering a culture of doing the right thing every time through giving people permission to give bad news, even when it's an unpopular thing to do, demonstrating that proactivity is embraced, valued and rewarded, rewarding ethical decisions and discussing ethics, opposing cynicism at all costs, but embracing scepticism constructively in terms of behaviour. Ensuring accessibility of all staff to the executive and encouraging boldness amongst all of our people. Being seen to act quickly on significant control issues. And we've placed a far greater focus on the value of new business or the present value of the expected future profits derived from new business. Now, contemporary enterprise risk management intends to connect risk to opportunities and value creation. And so going forward, we're going to increasingly rely on decision makers to exploit opportunities. And Craig Dunn he referred to that a number of times, empowering his business managers to make decisions. Now, in this context, the right organisational behaviours and culture have never been so important as we increasingly empower our decision makers to take controlled risks to create value. Now, I believe that, as I've said, that contemporary enterprise risk management must embrace both upside and downside risk. In fact, again, the IAA states that effective risk management implies an integrated assessment of adverse effects and opportunities. Now, as discussed, if we don't connect ERM with upside risks or opportunities, we'll break the link between risk management and business success. Therefore, by implication, a culture can develop whereby risk management is seen to be a stream of compliance and upside risk-taking is conversely perceived as a potential source of compliance concern. We certainly don't want that, that particular culture to take hold. The result can be risk elimination, which does not enable a business to pursue its objectives. This is a fractious situation and defeats the objective of making risk management enterprise-wide. The problem is compounded as this situation, can isolate a business as upside risk takers and has the potential to discourage the right behaviour amongst this critical group of decision makers. My general point here is inclusiveness. This is represented by the old compliance versus sales paradigm that we're all very familiar with and that simply doesn't fit and in fact is destructive to a modern ERM culture within an insurance business. At the same time, more balanced, risk-conscious contemporary professionals are less likely to remain, in my view, in a siloed environment where business objectives and risk management are not reconciled. These are the sorts of people with the behaviours that we want. So by not embracing upside risk in an ERM framework, we not only fail to properly address opportunities in the broader consideration of risks to a business, in terms of it not achieving its objectives, but we also create silos rather than enterprise-wide risk consciousness and potentially drive out the type of behaviours and competencies we need to manage our businesses effectively in a rapidly changing and uncertain world. I mentioned proportionality. The practice note from the IAA refers to proportionality principally around the size and complexity of a business, but it does go on to mention the maturity of a business. I think proportionality is critical, and I've made the point that if a business overstretches and attempts to implement a risk management framework that is beyond the available resources, systems, governance structures and talent within its business, this could cause enterprise risk management to become a philosophical discussion only that is remote from the practical day-to-day of the organisation, that can only be driven by process, which is necessarily imposed rather than embraced. Now, this means less buy-in and high levels of cynicism and frustration. So I think the board of any organisation, the executive team, need to consider an iterative approach to implementing enterprise-wide risk management, and they need to be careful of the downside risks associated with overstretching. And importantly, I think insurance supervisors and industry bodies need to be careful in their zeal to promote enterprise-wide risk management, not to trip organisations up that don't have the maturity to be able to embrace a particular sophisticated model effectively. Finally, I'd just like to mention black swans, since it was in the topic and no one's really referred to it, so I want to hold to that. But specifically, I would look at black swans as being, whilst they are defined as being historically rare and unforeseen, for the purposes of this discussion, I'll treat them as being analogous to the prospect of any significant unanticipated event. My point here is that we need to develop a linkage between our ERM, actuarial, and strategic planning functions within a business. And to Craig's earlier point, we need to ensure continuous ongoing assessment of external risks, emerging risks, and even potential black swan events. And And we need to do this as a way to develop the business's general competency to deal with unforeseen events rather than attempt to win the lottery and identify specific future unforeseen events. So this is about an organisational competency more than it is anything else. And that competency, which builds on the natural survival instincts of humans, which is something that complex actuarial models don't factor, it's a way to hone those instincts to ensure that a business is ready when that unforeseen event does happen, whatever it might be, and it is not paralysed by that shock, and then can move forward acting deliberately to minimise impacts or maximise opportunity as it strives to achieve its business objectives. So in conclusion, I would say that the IAA's contention that all management is risk management in a modern insurance business in the context of an increasingly uncertain world is absolutely correct. The essence of my argument in light of this is that insurance organisations need to strive to make ERM within their businesses authentic. Anything less than this will do more harm than good by relegating ERM to the realms of process, and in doing so creating and perpetuating silos, excluding a consideration of opportunities from risk management, and giving the wrong behaviours and poor culture an opportunity to develop. To make ERM authentic, I believe we need to focus on the fundamentals of proportionality of ERM, of an ERM framework to the stage of maturity and development of a business, the development of behaviours and culture that represent doing the right thing all the time, inclusion of upside risk in the equation, and the honing of an organisation's ability to manage unforeseen events by continuous assessment of all types of risks and opportunities, including black swan events. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, David. I've got a mic for you. Okay, we've got a few moments for a couple of questions, so I'll just give Damien a breather and ask Mark a question. So you certainly painted a picture of how challenging it was to implement risk appetite frameworks. And do you think, is there anybody who's doing this really well, do you think? And how do you think Australia, by and large, has risen to the challenge relative to global peers?
Thanks for the question, Mike. I think that it'd be tough to single out a particular institution, because that would probably be the kiss of death. The moment you mentioned somebody, I mean, 3 years ago, everybody thought UBS was the, you know, a world leader in risk management, right? So I'd rather not name names if that's okay, but let me make a couple of observations about Australia. I have to begin by saying I don't know all the details of everything that's gone on in all institutions in Australia, but I'm pretty familiar with the process that's been followed over the last 12 months in a couple of the majors. And what I would say about that is that overall, I think it's fairly good. I think the Aussie banks have done a reasonably good job of taking this seriously. I'm talking about the banks now, of taking this seriously, even though we didn't sustain the kinds of losses here that were sustained, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere and elsewhere. So they get, I'd say they get the importance of it. They're taking it seriously. It's been an area of high focus for the executive team and the board. Their frameworks have been significantly strengthened. And I'd say the two that I'm most familiar with would definitely say that they're absolutely, this is work in progress, not complete. They see it as a journey, an ongoing journey, and an iterative process. And you know, there's no sort of complacency or hubris about this. They get the importance of doing this well and are doing the best job they can to learn the lessons of what hasn't, of what's failed elsewhere.
Very good. And Damien, I like the idea of the risk-a-thon. It's always a smart move in Australia to give something a bit of a sporting theme, gets people on board. I got the sense of this sort of interactive discussion between executives and board. That's always a dangerous thing as a CEO, I would have thought, giving the board too much latitude, not quite knowing where they're heading. I mean, did that work well? I mean, is that the nature of the discussion? And were there any risks for you personally in that?
There's always risks for me personally, I think. But, so we won't cover those, but they've been excellent sessions. I think they started, this is an intensely intellectual exercise, isn't it? So they started, and you don't. It's counterproductive to have very tight agendas, because it then limits discussion on a topic that is incredibly expansive, right? So we started with, I guess, expectations that weren't too high in terms of concluding sessions with definite, specific outcomes, and if you like, gave the board permission to really wander through the issues. I should just correct myself slightly. The riskathons are positioned as board riskathons, which are supported by executive and senior management. So with the chief risk officer, the head of strategy and planning, and the chief actuary really taking a lead in terms of facilitation and providing analysis. So the obligation is theirs to move the discussion forward, and we're there to support. So that sort of removes any sort of conflict and frustrations associated with a peer-to-peer style discussion.
You introduced your presentation by talking about your key point, which was around proportionality. Did I get a sense that there might be stakeholders out there who are encouraging smaller players to move further and faster than they would like? And do you see that as a risk for institutions?
I don't have any particular observations, I guess, like the rest of us, on focusing very much on our organisation, but our observation has been that there is a potential to over-accelerate. Certainly, the regulators well and truly focused on moving organisations forward the right way here, and I think if that's not interpreted or managed correctly, there is a danger of actually moving backwards, as I've argued. So I think we just see the risk more than anything else, yeah.
And Mark, I guess a final question for you. I mean, do you think we are going to see changes in levels of risk-taking in US financial institutions and a change in mindset of US executives?
That's a left-field question. The short answer is we've already seen dramatic risk reduction, you know, deleveraging in the obvious areas, but substantial risk reduction in things like, you know, trading, right? And it's not being driven by the Volcker Rule and Congress. It's being driven by more by the imminent arrival of massively increased regulatory capital charges for the trading book, market risk, counterparty credit risk, and so on, which is making many of what used to be apparently profitable strategies economically unprofitable. And what I've seen over the last, say, 12 months is three or four of the largest financial institutions, both in the US and in sort of Western Europe, have made strategic decisions to essentially exit proprietary risk taking for that reason. I think it's being much more driven by the sort of the Basel initiatives, in particular the trading book charges from 18 months ago. Of course, we should acknowledge that we have whole new executive teams in those institutions. And so the real question is the religion about sort of risk reduction and prudent behaving prudently and so on. The question is, how sustainable will that be when the good times return and the blue skies back?
All right. Thanks very much, guys, for your time today. Thanks for your presentations and for taking time out. We do appreciate it. And if the team could just thank the guys in the normal way.